Welcome to Launch, where we explore the world of invention and entrepreneurship. I'm Jim DeBetta here with my co-host Ron Reardon and our producer Lee Cantor.
And Jim, how's the new addition to your family?
Well, she doesn't say much.
I heard you launched something new.
Yes, we launched a new child, our fourth. She's great. This one's a sleeper, though, which compared to the other three. Actually, real funny story. My wife, during the first few days, got so concerned that the baby had slept for so many consecutive hours that she actually called a couple of her girlfriends, one is a nurse, to say, should a baby be sleeping 7-8 straight hours?
Right.
And I'm like, yes, a baby should sleep that long.
That's a good kid.
We're just not used to having kids that sleep, so nice welcome change.
Yeah, and that reminds me of when my twin boys, Drew and Eric, slept through the night for the first time. I wake up. My heart starts racing. I'm in a panic. I go running in there. They're dead. They're dead, you know, and I put my hand underneath their nose, and they're still breathing. I'm like, they slept through the night.
Yeah, and that's those moments are nice, but we haven't had many of those with our kids, but they're better now. They're older, so obviously they do sleep, but everything's good. A little tired still. My wife obviously is tired, especially at night because she's breastfeeding, so that means that I can't do much.
So when are you moving back into the house?
Soon.
Like in a couple months this is all done?
When everything's, when I feel like she's getting enough sleep at night, I can come back.
Right. Well, I think the standard response from the husband is, honey, the baby's crying.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
So, so that's good. Everything's moving along. So what are we talking about today, Ron?
We're talking about your binocular business.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I think what we want to get through to people today is what it's really like from our perspective. Ron and I both have started businesses. So, Lee, you've started businesses, and our friends have started businesses, and our experiences have been varied.
Yeah, and I was fortunate in that I had a mentor at the very beginning that I picked up some tips of things not to do, one of which was you don't need a permanent office, okay? Because he talked about it for 2 years, he had a permanent office. He was a consultant, and nobody ever came to the office. He was always meeting with his clients someplace else, and he finally had to just drag somebody to his office.
Well, it makes you feel good, and you have an office, and just to say you have it. But, yeah, once you get into paying those monthly rents, you then say
that doesn't feel as good.
Doesn't feel as good.
Yeah, because you need to keep your fixed costs down as low as possible. And an office, that can be a real drain, especially if no clients are coming in that first year.
That's it. If you have clients, you need a space. If you don't have clients coming in, it really means absolutely nothing, and it is a waste of money to have a space.
And I have over 8,000 branch offices. They're called Starbucks.
And
Atlanta Bread, and we won't leave anybody out. Caribou Coffee.
Well, Ron, today you and I both obviously have service businesses, but back when I started, my business was a lot like what inventors are doing today, where they have a product, they're manufacturing, they have a warehouse, and I lost a lot of money, and I didn't have a mentor specifically. I obviously asked for help from people, but I didn't have anybody I can turn to.
Right. So how'd you do that? What, you were just making it up as you went along?
To some degree, yeah, we did. We took a lot of chances, and we didn't have money.
Right.
So like a lot of inventors, we just didn't have cash. And think, when you're in your early 20s...
And you think you know everything, that's even worse.
Oh, of course we knew everything.
Yeah, right. You're 8 foot tall and bulletproof. Yeah, but I think most entrepreneurs make it up as they go.
Yeah. Well, there's no manual.
Well, right. I mean, the good entrepreneurs, right. They're going to take risks that other people wouldn't take. But they certainly go out of their way to always be learning things and learning business techniques, not necessarily what they're doing specifically, but they understand that they've got to read books, they've got to reach out to other people and get advice when they can.
So where did you go? Like when you had to make big, what was the first kind of big decision you kind of remember during the course of your binocular business?
Well, the number one thing is getting your brand out there. So here we are, this little company. We're selling a couple of retailers, but how do we get everybody to notice us?
But how'd you get, let's go even back further. How'd you get to that first retailer? You had the binoculars. How'd you get in there?
We got on the phone because there was no real internet to speak of. And we called buyers.
So you just called. You just opened up the Yellow Pages.
Basically. We would go to trade shows, and obviously we'd talk to other people in other booths and say, do you know who the buyer is for this or that? Believe it or not, we'd go to the library, library, and pull out information. There were books and things printed and articles and journals where you can try to get some name of somebody.
Right.
And we would call up and just say, look, we've got this product. We want to send you a sample. Are you interested? Type of thing. And we didn't know what to say and how to say it. But
the library is a great resource, and that's a resource that a lot of people don't even think to go, even though they have all the reference books.
Still a good place to go.
And I'd like to talk about the libraries in my county where I live, Gwinnett. Mm-hmm. They're under a budget crunch, and they've already made the decision to close the libraries, all the libraries in the county, on Sundays and Mondays, and to cut back the other hours. Now, not only does that have an impact on the kids that want to go there after school or to study or whatever, but all the job seekers and people, you know, like Jim that are starting a business that are, you know, need those yellow pages or the trade journals or whatever, that's going to have a negative impact on business.
But thank God for the internet now. So at least you have those resources available to you. But, you know, beyond that, you talk about where did we spend money wrong. That's a big thing, because a lot of inventors get concerned about their limited budgets. How do they spend their money? And everybody wants to be known and popular and have their brand out there. But we spend a lot of money on ads, like running print ads in consumer and trade magazines. And some of those ads, when I look back, were really just a waste of money.
Were you looking at the ads and tracking the results, or were you just kind of putting them out there and kind of hoping that they were going to do something?
We didn't know anything about tracking, and the salespeople never told us anything about that. I mean, again, we were younger, and we figured, you know what, look, if we run an ad in Field and Stream or Sports Illustrated, you know, in that sporting world, yeah, if we spend $5,000 on a half-page ad, sure, everyone's going to see us, and then they're going to call us up and want to buy our stuff, and nobody called, and nobody knew who we were. And then after you spend $50,000, you kind of kick yourself in the butt and say, what in the world did I just do? Right. So that was a big expenditure that we should never have made, and inventors and startups should not be advertising on a consumer level in print like that until they've got their house in order in other ways.
And I agree with that completely. I mean, you were asking about the tracking. I'll notice on certain ads in magazines like that, they'll say, you know, Sweet W.
Right.
You know, or something, or, you know, Sweet 101 or whatever. And, you know, they see the same ad for the same company in another thing, and it'll say Sweet A, you know. And so they're trying to, you know, when people call in, was like, you know, where did you see us? You know what suite did it say? Just to find out, you know, which ads were working.
Right. And that's something that people, again, they don't realize. They put an ad out, and they could put 5 different ads out, and then they can get a lot of orders in, but that might come from one source, and the other 4 could be worthless. And if you don't track it properly, you don't know which is the good place to advertise and which are the not so good. Yeah,
but in Jim's case, he knew that none of them were working.
Right. I mean, there was nobody telling me what the response rate was, but I didn't need anybody to tell me that the phone was not ringing.
Right.
So that's the ultimate response rate answer. I mean, I wasn't getting any sales, but we then turned to trade ads. So for people that, let's say you have a sporting good product, instead of advertising in Sports Illustrated.
To a consumer
who, A, if you're not selling any retailers, what's the point? Because where are they going to go to buy it?
Right.
Unless you have a website and you're driving them there. But you should advertise to the trade. The buyers at all these major retail chains, they read the trade magazines. So if you want to get noticed by the very people who can actually put your product in front of consumers.
In front of lots of consumers.
Right. So, Lee, if you're a buyer for, you know, Walmart or Target or something, and you read whatever sporting goods trade magazine, and there's a number of them, but if you read that and you see my ad consistently, eventually you're going to at least say, you know what, maybe I should give these guys a ring or have my assistant give them a call.
Right.
Or better yet, if you know who I am and then I call you 6 months later, you may say, yeah, you know, I've seen your ad. And that used to happen a lot to us.
Right.
And that gave us a little bit more of a warm lead into those buyers than just being somebody new.
Because the inventors have to realize the buyer's job is to find these kind of hidden gems and the new stuff that's out there. They got to always be on top of things.
Well, I've actually yelled at a few buyers and, you know, in frustration when they said, well, I'm not interested. I'm like, isn't it your job to, to buy things? And why won't you at least take a look? And those usually don't go anywhere, those conversations.
No kidding. But
when you get mad.
Right, that's not a good
and
strategy.
And you got a buyer who's not, you know, not open to listening or hearing you, and you've got something legitimate for them.
Right.
It's a frustration.
Yeah, and I think the key word that you just said was the consistently. Because, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs don't realize that, you know, just because the ad goes out there one time, that everybody's going to pick up the phone and like that. But if they see it, you know, month after month after month, you know, then eventually they'll say, oh, yeah, these guys have got some staying power. They've been there.
You wear them down.
Yeah, that's a big mistake. And that's perfect, Ron, that you cannot run an ad just once or twice. And anybody, any good ad rep that is selling you an ad will tell you. It sounds like they're trying to sell you on more ads, but all the research can tell you all day long that you need to run ads consistently. I used to run ads like 3 months, pull the ad out 1 month, run it for 3 or 4 months, pull it out a month. Because then when people don't see it and then they see it again, they're like, oh, you know, I recognize that. Where's that company been?
Right.
So I've done that, but I've always done campaigns of a year, 2 years, knowing that it takes that long. It's not an overnight thing to get recognized.
Yeah. I noticed that, you know, I've got Inventor's Digest magazine in front of me, and there's a Jim DeBetta article in there. And I think there's been Jim DeBetta articles in there pretty consistently month after month.
Right. And maybe for 6 months you didn't even notice it. But eventually, if you are a consistent reader of that magazine, and I write for Inventor's Digest and have been for over a year, you'll get to know. And I get more calls today than I got the first month I was writing because
right.
people that are dedicated readers say, hey, Jim, I've been reading your stuff. I follow your stuff. And it can pay off. So even in that particular instance, Ron, that's perfect. Like you said, you read the magazine.
Right.
But if you heard my name somewhere, you'd be like, yeah, I know that guy from somewhere. And that's
right.
all you want to accomplish, that recognition.
Right.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of times on the radio, you hear these one-hit wonders where they'll have these series of they'll play the song, and this band had one hit, and that's
right.
all they had. Okay. And so you don't want to be a one-hit wonder, you know, with advertising. You want to have that consistency.
Yeah, not if you're building a sustainable business, that's for sure. So that was definitely one way that I spent a lot of money. But, you know, I made another mistake that a lot of people make today. I get calls constantly about this, bringing in too much inventory. Big problem.
Very big problem. I've got some clients that when they came to me, you know, for the patent work, they already had the shipment, you know, en route from China.
Before the patent work was done?
Before the patent work was done, okay.
That doesn't sound like a good plan.
No. Well, not only was that not a good plan, I mean, they had an investor that had, you know, paid for the, you know, manufacturing of all this stuff. And I checked with them later when we got an allowance on the patent application, and they didn't have the money to pay for the allowance. And they had not sold a single one of the 6,000 of these items that they had in the warehouse. Because every time that they, you know, went to, they should have talked to Jim, is what they should have done.
That's right.
But they, you know, whenever they would contact folks, they would just find out, well, you're just an individual and you're not a company, and, you know, and they were going nowhere. And of course, the investor was getting kind of ticked because they did, you know,
they own 6,000
of the stuff that they can't move.
Well, what's really wrong with that, guys, is that it's one thing to bring in inventory. It's another thing to bring in good quality inventory. So if Ron goes ahead and makes a product, he doesn't understand how to package it correctly. He doesn't understand how to create good logos or taglines or anything that is involved in the presentation. If he brings in a product and it just looks bad or it's not technically correct, that's a big problem. If you send those samples to buyers, they may say, well, I don't like it, or it's not right, or it just looks weird. Those are the people that often get stuck. I mean, it's okay to bring in inventory, but I like pre-selling. Some people are against this, but I like, for certain clients of mine, I will call on retail buyers and send them some samples. And
say, what do you think?
Before okay, they go right. ahead and order 5,000, 10,000
right.
pieces, because the buyers that I know that I'm friends with will say, Jim, you know what? They should probably change this or change that. And forgetting about patents, Ron, because the patents aren't going to pertain to the package design, right?
Correct.
So, I mean, yeah, there may be some trademark type stuff, but putting that aside, if you're selling a men's product and it's in a pink package, the buyer may say, I think you need to go
blue?
With the blue, right, or brown or something.
Right.
And I've seen people make big mistakes because they haven't sought out that kind of help.
Right.
And then they get stuck with inventory that is really hard to sell.
And then when a buyer kind of gives their opinion, doesn't that help you sell into that buyer? Because now they kind
of
own it already because they've participated in the making of
Absolutely.
It.
I mean, good buyers at retail are involved, and they understand product, and they'll give feedback and because they want it to sell.
Right.
I mean, they're not just buyers. I mean, that's what they are. But good buyers definitely know the business. And I have a couple of buddies that I was talking to my friend Dave yesterday, who used to be a buyer for Target and for Brookstone. And he'll look at a product differently than an inventor's going to look at it because he wants to make sure it's going to be enticing and people are going to pick it up and buy it quickly. So feedback like that is tremendous.
Yeah, because, you know, I'm sure that buyers have had a learning curve also when they first got started. And, you know, they made mistakes. And, you know, once you start talking to an experienced buyer, they know what works and they know what does not work.
It's one of the old things. Why make a mistake when there are people around you who can help you avoid them?
Right. And it's in their best interest, the buyer's best interest to help.
It's sad. I get calls a lot for people that order, and I'm not talking about 1,000 pieces, people that order well into the five figures and into the six figures, and then they call up almost in tears. And
you're
saying,
kidding
Jim,
me. Somebody would order six figures of something.
All the time.
Just on a hope and a prayer?
This is not, you know, once a year I get this. This is...
You have got to be kidding me.
Once a month. And this is just, these are just the people that call me. So imagine all the people that, A, are afraid to call somebody and say they've got that amount of products sitting around. And like you said, it's okay to do it if you've got a bigger plan. And
right.
You've got a sales team. And some of these people call me and say, Jim, I've got a product and it looks good, but they're not, they don't want to go out and sell. They don't have anybody to help them sell it. And it's cash sitting in their house.
Man.
Yeah, because it takes a team. You know, usually inventors are really good at inventing, but they're not very good at all the other activities that are required to get that product out into the marketplace.
You know, there was this big debate. I think I kind of got it going on Edison Nation's forum, where I put out a forum topic about people, inventors with passion, and, you know, what does it take to sell? And a couple people came back and said, well, you need passion. And it, you got, as an inventor, you got to try to do as much as you can yourself, and no one's going to sell your product better than you. And I actually said, no, you know what? I can actually sell many inventors' products better than they can. Forget about the passion. You do need it. But when you sit in front of a buyer, they don't want to see you crying, and they don't want to hear your life story. They need to know, what's it cost? How much money is it for me? Do you understand my customers that shop my stores? Is it selling anywhere else? How's the package look? What's the pricing like? You know, that's the stuff they want to know.
It's the blocking and tackling, you know. It's not the big pass. I think the inventors get hung up in the drama of this because it's like we've said over and over, it's their baby, you know. It's so important to them.
Yeah, and they do have passion, you know, tremendous passion about it. And the challenge that I have with a lot of inventors is they get so hung up on the features of what's cool about the invention and totally forget about the benefits, to a buyer or to a retailer or to the user.
Well, that's it. There's the benefits to us, and then what's the benefit to the buyer? So you have two benefits, right? I mean, a lot of products have benefits if you look for them and they exist. I mean, everybody's product has something that is useful to somebody. But if it doesn't fit the mold of what a retailer is looking for or what strangers, objective people, are looking for, then the product is just that. But you got to have passion, and you don't want to go in and... Hi, I've got a product.
Right, here's another one of my products.
You want to be excited. You definitely do, but that's not enough. If you don't know how to market, you find somebody who can help you.
Right.
Or learn how to market. If you don't know how to sell, if you don't know anything about patents, go to somebody that knows about patents.
Right.
You can't let pride get in the way and emotions get in the way and think because you've come up with something, because that idea is just that. It's an idea. An idea is not sellable. It's not marketable.
Right.
And you can't put an idea on a store shelf. It's got to be tangible.
Yep, I agree.
Let's get back to your binocular story. Now you've started selling into a couple of retailers. What was the next? When did you start really kind of finding those trusted advisors to work with that really kind of took your business to another level?
Believe it or not, my most trusted advisors, if you will, were my competitors.
Mm-hmm.
You go, especially at trade shows, you'd walk around and I'd go to talk to the other optics companies, and I'd walk in, and some of them weren't as friendly. They kind of see you and they view you as a competitor. But I became friendly with some other national sales managers or VPs or presidents of some of the other companies. And typically the smaller companies get together and they want to help each other. If you're a behemoth, if you're a billion-dollar company, those salespeople are kind of high and mighty. They don't want anything to do with you, so they push themselves off and don't really say much to you.
Right. But so you were able to kind of create alliances with some of the smaller firms?
Yes, definitely so. And you trade stories, you share trade secrets.
Right, like
trade
best practices.
Right. And, you know, hey, Ron, do you know the buyer for this place? Or, hey, Jim, do you know, about this product? Whatever it is. And that's where you really learn a lot. And from sales reps, I learned a lot from the older sales reps that we used to have, like the guys that had been around the block quite a bit, and they know the business and they have a lot of connections. They have a lot of wisdom that you don't have when you're in your 20s.
Yeah, because, you know, they say that experience is the best teacher, especially if it's somebody else's experience.
Right. It's more efficient that way.
Yeah, it's better to, instead of burning your own hand on the stove, is to see somebody else burn their hand.
Right, like don't do that.
Note to self, do not put hand on stove, you know.
Yeah, especially where I got a lot of information was when for these buyer meetings where when I first started going to see buyers, I would ask these reps, well, what do you say to them? What should I expect when I go in there?
Right.
I mean, I didn't really have anybody go with me, but to get that advice from somebody who's done it 1,000 times right. is useful.
What was it like that first time you were in front of a buyer?
It's you get
probably nervous, yeah, right?
Absolutely. I'm sure it was ugly.
But yeah, it was like, you know, it was important to you, right? Because this is like a critical
step. Oh, yeah,
step
you're definitely nervous. There's no question about it. And you go in there and you tend to talk too much.
Right.
Sell too much. And you're not asking the buyer what they want. You're just telling them all about you. And that's what I see with inventors. And that's okay because that's a normal thing. But you got to go in there and do some listening. And
you know, in the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie, he talks about what's called white magic, which is the power of listening, that people want to be listened to.
Right. And when you ask a buyer, some buyers feel better and more important and useful when you ask them their opinion about your product instead of just saying, my product's great, my product's going to sell all over the place, you're going to make millions. They hear that all day long.
All day long.
What are you going to do to engage them? If Ron's the buyer, it's, Ron, how's your business? How are sales of binoculars these days? Any particular SKUs of binoculars, sizes, shapes, anyone selling bad, anyone selling really well, what's the customer reaction? I mean, these are the things you want to ask a buyer.
So there are, so I guess I would think that when you first do it, you're apprehensive to ask those kind of questions because it seems like you don't know the answer and you think that you're not, maybe you're being perceived as not, you know, really that on top of things.
I don't know if it's apprehension. It's just you tend to want to go in and tell your story
and just talk about you.
How great your stuff is. That's what a lot of people would do and what I did. Yeah, look what I've got. I've got this. It's awesome. It's going to do really great. Look how we packaged it. The buyer's going, you know, blah, 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 blah. How do I make money? Blah, blah.
Right.
That's all they care about. That, I mean, and that's what they should care about because they have a job to do. That's the tendency. That was my biggest thing. And then you learn to listen more and ask more questions. And
so really, it's okay to ask questions.
Oh, though. You have to. How right. else are you going to know if what you're trying to sell them could possibly work unless you know what the buyer needs? Ask somebody what they need instead of just telling them what they should have.
Now, when you were in there, did you ever ask them questions and then you're like, you know what, maybe this isn't the right fit for this store?
That definitely happens. And I've told a lot of clients that sometimes you got to walk away from a deal or if they try to drive the price too low. And that's, you know, you talk about business mistakes. One of the mistakes people make is they tend to want to cut their price just to get in. I've had a lot of people say, well, if I can just sell Walmart and break even, or even if I lose a little money, hey, I'm getting into Walmart. I said, you should never make a deal where you lose money. What's the point? You're a business. What business tries to do business to lose money?
It's like, well, we lose money on every deal, but we make it up in volume.
Right, yeah, exactly, right, yeah. You make nothing from nothing in volume. And, you know, getting your product into Walmart or any mass merchant certainly is a good branding and marketing thing for
right.
you, but that doesn't mean that you're going to be successful everywhere else, and it doesn't mean that everybody's going to buy your product because of that.
Now, if you get into, I guess their thought process is, well, if I get this one in, even if it's at a loss, the next one I'll be able to, it'll be easier to get the second product in.
Yeah, but you don't always get that chance. Let's say I sell Ron a product, and I break even, and the product doesn't perform well. Well, I don't get a second shot, so now I don't have that opportunity
and
to make it
I've
up.
And plus I've lost.
But there are strategies. I mean, that's a whole other conversation. But there are strategies where people use loss leaders or they use something. You go to a store sometimes and they'll sell Snicker bars for 50 cents.
Right.
And meanwhile, you know that they're losing money, and that's on an end cap. But as soon as you get down the aisle, they're charging 20% more for
something else.
Right. And that's where they make the money. But those are more in-depth retail strategies than, you know, business strategies for inventors to go into.
So the inventor with their products, they got to know their numbers exactly because they can't be pushed around by the buyer. Because does the buyer just like, you know, the buyer needs them to make money so they keep making products, right? So, but they want to get as low of a price as possible.
Everybody's got to make money. Good buyers understand that the vendors have to make money, they have to make money, and the consumer gets a good value. If all that happens, then everybody wins. And everyone's happy.
But don't the buyers sometimes just keep pushing, go, look, you know, I can't sell that for $10. That has to be $8.
Again, you'll get, most buyers are good in that way. They understand that there's only so low that things could be made. And good buyers understand the manufacturing process.
Mm-hmm.
They understand that if you bring them this widget, that it's not going to be made for $1. You know, it just, they understand that kind of stuff. But again, it's one of those things where when a buyer does his or her job correctly, they want to get you down. Of course, it's more money in their pocket, but they're not going to go so far as to make it a bad deal for you. So
right.
you don't make, because if you don't make money, then you can't supply them and they can't sell the product anymore.
Right.
And sometimes you have this sinking feeling in your stomach, okay, when you're in this situation, because, you know, when you started the journey, you said, well, this people will pay $99 for this.
Okay? Right.
And you put your whole business around that, and then you go into the buyer, and the buyer says, you know, $29.99 is about all anybody's going to pay for it. And all of a sudden you realize you've made a serious error at the very beginning that you're just now finding out about.
You know, and Ron, when you talk about, if we kind of skip back over to what you do with patents, I mean, this is one of those areas where you talk about a startup business. I tell a lot of people I never filed any patents, and I saved myself a lot of money. But one thing I never did skip was thorough patent searches, and I always trademarked all our names because I was more afraid of getting sued for copying somebody's idea than I was about having a patent to protect the idea, because I knew we were going to cycle through our products quickly.
Right. Yeah. And if it's, you know, you don't need a patent if, you know, something that you've got is going to sell for about a year or two. I mean, just patents, you know, would be a waste of money. But that the research you're talking about is important. Here in Atlanta, we have a company that was purchased not too long ago called Scientific Atlanta. When they started off, they put SA on all their literature and stuff like that, and called themselves Scientific Associates, okay? And they got this cease and desist letter, you know, a couple of months after they got started, from another company in Atlanta that was called Scientific Associates that had a registered trademark for that.
Right.
And they're like, what are we going to do now? I mean, we can't call ourselves Scientific Associates. You know, we got to destroy all these business cards and literature like that. But we got this SA all over everything. Well, we're in Atlanta. Why don't we change it from Scientific Associates to Scientific Atlanta? And that's how they ended up with the name.
And that's good, because they outlived probably Scientific Associates.
Yes, they did. Yes, they did.
So you have to be, in that instance, you have to always understand that if you're going to run a business, that you can't just skip the legal stuff.
No.
You want to, because that tendency is it's just a waste of money, or it's not going to help me for my business. And I made those mistakes. A lot of times I didn't seek counsel for certain things, or just having like employment agreements, or, you know, rep contracts. I used to just say, oh, you know, shake hands, let's get it done. But you find out that it's the second you get into some kind of skirmish with somebody, if you don't have any documents or records or anything signed by both parties agreeing to what's going to be done, that could be a very costly and stressful event.
Yeah, because, you know, your intellectual property strategy is supposed to support your business strategy. The business strategy starts first. And so, you know, if you have a product that's going to sell for a year or two, then that's going to drive the strategy one way. But if you've got something like Velcro or, you know, Kevlar, Teflon, something like that, that's going to sell year after year, then that's a totally different strategy.
Right. You better button that up.
No kidding.
Yeah, so the legal stuff, in the very beginning, we didn't pay much attention to it, but you know, a couple of years later, we definitely...
But if you would have invented some innovative way to make binoculars or some optic thing, that's something you would have patented, right?
Oh, absolutely. And we looked at patenting, you know, a few things over time, that when we came up with some revolutionary ideas that we thought could be patentable. But we would then sit down and say, how long is it going to be before somebody comes along and does a version of what we were doing? And
right.
Since we ultimately had over 100 SKUs, can you imagine if we had to go and patent even a quarter of them? We'd spend probably a lot of our profit.
And time.
It was a business decision for us.
Bingo.
But you know, again, we got into some licensing deals, and then the IP stuff quickly came up again. So that's when it becomes important. But Ron said it, where you got to have your business strategy, but you got to cover the legal stuff. You got to understand how long your life cycle of your products are. If you're going to build a business around just a couple of products and be in business for 10, 15 years, it might be a wise thing to consider to file patents and at least seek out some protection there.
Yeah, because when you start a business, the very first thing you should think about is, well, how am I going to sell this business? And when am I going to sell it? You know, what's my exit strategy? And so then that's when you start looking at, well, what's going to be the value when we sell this, or when we're acquired? Is it going to be in the intellectual property? Is it going to be in our clients? Is it going to be in our brand? You know, where's the value and how can we maximize it?
And you're seeing a lot of companies... What the buying company buys is the intellectual property, so than everything else.
Yeah, one of my favorite stories is there was a company that bought a Rolls-Royce company, and what they didn't realize is that another company owned the trademark for Rolls-Royce, and they didn't get that when they bought the company. They got the company, but they didn't get the other part, the trademark, and they had to you know, it was kind of one of those sinking feelings in the stomach when they had to go negotiate with that other company that actually owned the trademark.
Who has a lot more leverage now.
Yeah, that could be a deal killer. I mean, that come to think of it, you're right. Any transactions we ever went through, it was always, and the intellectual property, the inventory, goodwill, right. You know, IP was always in there in whatever form.
Yeah, because, I mean, you assume that when you're buying the company, you're buying the brand and the trademark like that, but you need to check and find out, well, exactly who does own this, you know?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's legal. Definitely a big big deal with us with not considering in the beginning and then making it more of a priority. Another thing is employees. You learn the tendency is a lot of people, and I was like this, you want to build like this big company. So you want to have a lot of employees and say you run this big company.
Right.
But then you start looking back and you say, well, why am I shelling out hundreds of thousands of dollars a month to 10 people when 5 people could probably do the job better?
Right.
Or you start to pick and choose who you really need and not getting too lazy for yourself and saying, what can I really do that I'm best at?
Right.
And then how do I surround myself with real specialists or experts? I mean, you need an admin person when you're running a consumer products company, that's for sure. You definitely need sales and marketing people. But beyond that, you start to say, who do I really need here and at what cost?
Right.
Yeah. Especially when you start looking at your fixed cost structure and how much product you've got to move to support that. Because, as soon as you cross the threshold of having, I think it's maybe 3 employees, all of a sudden you've got to have a personnel manual.
All these HR issues start popping up.
Yeah, and you've got to think about the Social Security tax and the, what is it called, when you get sick and
Medicare, Medicaid,
yeah,
that
kind of stuff. I'm thinking about the when you fire somebody and you got to actually
The workers' comp.
Workers' comp.
There
you
go. Right, and that's like when people come to us and inventors, and they want us to sell their products. And for those that we agree to work with, and we give them a price for the work, we justify it by saying, listen, to hire one person, forget their salary, the workers' comp, the health benefits,
exactly,
which are expected today, the vacation time. All those responsibilities and have cost to them.
Yeah.
So would you rather lease out your sales effort to a company that you don't have to deal with any of that stuff?
Right.
Or would you rather bring somebody on and then you train them and you teach them everything they know, and then if they just quit and leave, then with all your business and your accounts and contacts, then
right.
And
that's
I've seen
risky.
That a lot. I've seen that a lot.
Yeah, because having employees should not be an ego decision. Okay, it needs to be a business decision.
No, that's a math decision.
It's a math decision that your business can support.
How many more products do I have to sell to afford this guy?
Right.
Right. And one of the big things, one of the mistakes I did not make, and I think this is something I encourage all startups to think about, is we spent a lot of money on salespeople. Nothing happens until somebody sells something. You don't have warehouse workers. You don't have admin. You don't have HR. You don't have anything unless there's revenue coming in. So I wanted my money spent on getting people in front of buyers and selling products to them. Once the money started rolling in,
then you can hire
all those other people and justify the cost. And
when you were hiring the salespeople, did you get them as salaried employees, or were they commission only, or some combination?
Always hired dedicated people that I paid very generous salaries to, because I wanted the best. I didn't want to have to spend a year teaching somebody how to sell. And I didn't care what industry they came from. You could usually tell when you interview somebody if they can sell, if they've got a good personality, if they can speak well with others and work in that world. And from there, you spend a few weeks, you teach them your products. But if somebody can sell, they can sell most anything.
Right.
So that was a big thing for me, getting the best I could afford. I tried going around and going through other people in the industry and trying to see if anybody got laid off, quit. You want to getting somebody in the industry is certainly helpful.
Right.
Yeah, and the visual that I use with entrepreneurs to kind of explain what you're talking about is the funnel technique. Because the wider the funnel at the beginning, as far as prospects and people exposed to your product, the more it's going to be dropping out down at the bottom as far as, clients or customers that have actually paid for the product and everything.
Right.
And if you're just doing the selling yourself, then that's a very small mouth to the funnel.
Right.
But if you did like what Jim's talking about, of getting really good qualified folks that know, how to sell and everything, then all of a sudden you've got a very wide, top to that funnel, and you're going to get a lot better results.
And another thing I spent money on wisely was the look and image of our company. Initially, we had not such a great look, but then I went out and actually spent a lot of money on rebranding our name, our logo. We actually changed the name, changed the logos completely, came up with all the taglines, new websites, new brochures, new trade show booths. I spent a lot of money on that because, to me, image was critical,
right,
especially for a fast-growing small company that wanted to get noticed. We wanted to look very professional, very right, consistent, and we wanted people to see us and remember us wherever they saw us. So those two things, the whole branding and the sales, to me, were tremendous. Everything else was really second.
Right. So even though the design may not have impacted the functionality of anything you were doing, you felt it was important to invest in good design?
Well, I knew that long-term it was going to have an impact. I knew that, well, if I spend, and I'm making up a number here, you know, $20,000 on redoing the logos and the look of our websites, I knew that wasn't going to make a sale at a major retailer that day. But I knew 6 months, a year, 2 years down the road that it would have a big impact.
Yep, and, you know, taglines are important. I mean, a lot of people will look at a tagline that's a real winner, but it's really a simple thing.
Right.
You know, when people say, Coke is it. You know, how much did they pay for that? I'm sure they paid a lot. Okay,
right.
And then
is it? Why would they spend all that money for two little words, you know, or just do it? Well, how hard is that? I could have thought of that. That's three words.
One of my favorites is, you know, Sarah Bakely of Spanx here in Atlanta. The tagline that's on all of her clothing says, "Don't worry, we've got your butt covered."
Yeah, but it's, you know, right, not genius stuff, but something you remember, something
yeah, right,
you'll say to somebody. It's our whole thing was changing the way you view optics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it, people would say, "Well, so how are you?"
Right.
Prompted
intrigue.
It's
yeah,
something that people would remember.
Right.
It's an easy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a lot of we saw companies going too deep, very complicated taglines and technical taglines.
Right.
That's not stuff people want to remember. Consumers need to just remember something that, like, just do it, or
mm-hmm,
something that's very easy that you can recite in your head and remember it.
Right.
Remember that company by. So that was a big expenditure and definitely well worth.
But that's an investment. Those are investments
right,
that can really pay off down the road. And a lot of times I think people get a little short-sighted in that area.
Well, again, it's kind of like what happened with us. I mean, if you don't have money,
right,
it may look like you're short-sighted. The reality is if you just don't have the money, you don't have the money. You have to pick and choose.
But it's prioritized. You got to decide what are the most important things to spend the money on, because we've all determined that you have to spend money.
Right. And Ron, hopefully you'll agree with this. I think when you're an inventor and you've got a product, you've got to spend money on the look and feel of your product. The package has to be great. It's got to be impulsive. I think your logo, your whole branding, your website, your look has to be there.
Right.
Because then people aren't going to take you seriously. They're not going to think you're in business to be in business for the long haul. And, you know, aside from all the legal stuff and all the other things that you have to always go through, like patent searches and stuff, you've got to get out and sell stuff.
Right.
So if you don't have a good sales effort, again, you really don't have nothing. There's nothing to build on.
Yeah, and when you look at the statistics about, you know, how many businesses fail, you know, in the first 5 years, and it's, you know,
the vast majority.
Yeah, at least 80% of them. It's because entrepreneurs consistently underestimate how much time it's going to take before things really start cooking, and they seriously underestimate how much money it's going to take to get everything's going.
Right.
Yeah, when I send clients out a questionnaire, one of my questions is, do you understand the cost of starting up a consumer products company, or do you understand the cost of developing a product? And sometimes people will just put a few thousand dollars, and it's amazing. Some people put $1 million. It's funny. You see some
right,
of the answers. But, I mean, it's always going to be tens of thousands of dollars. I don't care what you read or you hear about somebody in some magazine that, oh, they started a business on $300. No, they didn't.
Right.
They didn't. I mean, I want to meet the person who started a business on a couple $100, and it's so rare.
Right.
You know, the reality is that you know, to do a patent search, yes, you can do one on your own, but you can skimp on everything too.
Right.
And get lucky. But that's usually what happens, unless your product is just so amazing and it's something that really is unique and changes the world, so to speak, you can maybe get away with it. But for everybody else.
Right. But those are the exceptions. Everybody wants to look at these anomalies as ways of, like, hey, see, this guy did it, so I can do that too, just like that. And it's just the odds are so against you.
Yeah, because I think one mistake a lot of entrepreneurs make, especially when they're doing revenue projections, is they say, well, you know, if we only just get 1% of this market,
right,
you know, we'll be
gazillionaires. So easy to get
1%. Oh, yeah. 1%, that's very conservative. It's
right,
like, no, it takes a whole lot to get 1% of any market, you know.
Yeah, and I see that too. And I often, actually, I get a lot of business plans sent to me. And the people that seem to be realistic are the people that say in their first year they're going to lose some money. I'm intrigued. Now I'm going to read on.
Right.
Because that's real. Yeah. I mean, these people in the same, they're going to spend money.
Right.
And they're going to invest in their business. Mm-hmm. And then year two, you see they make some money, and then it starts to escalate. And that's when you see a good business plan. When you see these people that say, year one, I make $6 million. Year two, $82 million. Right. I've seen plans like
and
this.
And like a billion by year five.
And yet you look at their advisory team or their organization, it's a husband and wife.
Right.
And unless you were a former buyer or you were very successful in selling major retailers and you've got a just the process alone takes months and months and months, that's not going to happen. So you can almost always tell when people are realistic about what they're doing just by their financials and their business plans.
Yeah, if it says in year three we expect to break even, now you might have a good business plan.
Right.
Because they know it's going to go negative the first year, and then it's going to start climbing up to zero in that second year.
Right.
And then the third year, then it might start breaking even, go positive.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are endless things that we did wrong. I mean, there were definitely things we did right, and obviously the right things overtook the wrong things. And,
right.
and in a way, we got lucky.
And that's what it takes, though. I mean, it's a combination of everything and a little luck, and,
What I think the phrase is, the harder I work, the luckier I get.
Exactly. Yeah. Who said that? I see that on the internet a lot lately. People, like on Twitter and stuff like that. It was like, that was Thomas Jefferson, I think, said that, actually. And I don't know why I actually know that right here and now, but I remember reading, somebody put it on one of the social networks, and it was like, Thomas Jefferson, it seems like the harder I work, the luckier I get, so I'll keep working hard. I don't know, something like that. But it's true. It's a combination of everything. But the takeaway on that is that you're going to spend money. There's just no way around that. You can't just bring in $1 billion worth of inventory and not at least have somebody take a look at what your product is, the packaging, the pricing, to make sure that it is viable, that it could actually be sold. You've got to do some legal stuff. You've got to do, at the very least, if you're not going to file patents, do a patent search. Look at your rep agreements with people that are going to sell your products and make sure that it's an understanding there. There's so much available information, and the resources exist all over the internet. Get information. Don't just start a business because you see somebody else making millions and think that it just happens.
Like by magic.
Right. You've got to do a lot of work, and you've got to make sure you don't hire too many people. You don't get too far ahead of yourself. It's okay to be a one-person show in the beginning. A lot of people were, but learn the steps, go slowly, be conservative. Don't go out and get a $2,000 a month office space when you could just as well work in your house.
Right.
I mean, today you need a computer, a phone, a scanner.
Exactly.
What else do you really need to market and grow your business?
Right.
Other than some expertise.
Yeah, the internet has really allowed entrepreneurs to be able to do things very inexpensively.
Especially on the marketing side,
right,
where you have social media
and research
marketing.
And the research side.
Yeah, you don't have to go to the library. And in Gwinnett County, obviously, you can't go to the library anymore because
Sundays
it's only open
and
2 hours a day. But
Tuesday through Saturday, I guess between 10 and 4, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it may sound a little harsh, but there's almost no excuse for an inventor today to say that they didn't understand the steps to inventing or the process.
Right.
There's just too many resources. If you Google patents, or you Google sales and marketing, or what is it, 10, 20 million things come up, and then it's just asking other people and other inventors that you may have read about. I mean, if you see an inventor in Inventor's Digest who was successful, I bet you if you email them or call them, they'll call you back.
Exactly.
They want to tell,
they
talk
tell
about
their
story.
Exactly.
And you could say, well, who did you use for a patent? Who did you use for sales and marketing? Who did you use for this? What did you do?
Right.
All day long. So
people like to help people.
Of course.
You can't be afraid to make those calls.
And, we want to help people too. And Ron, I know you do a lot of free stuff, and I do a lot of free stuff because it's human. You
right.
do want to help people. But at the same time, when somebody comes to me and makes massive mistakes with all that's available on the internet and with all the resources, I feel bad for them. But at the same time, I shake my head and I say, how in the world did you get in this position?
Right.
And unfortunately, it's going to continue to happen regardless of what's out there.
Yeah, I like to help, entrepreneurs and inventors make these go, no-go decisions at the very beginning before they spend any money.
Right.
Let's take a look at this. How big is that market? Does your product have a wow factor? Why would somebody gonna buy this instead of, what's already out there? And a lot of people that come to me, they walk away from their idea because they realize at the beginning, you know, I'm not going to make any money off this. It's just not going to go. Because I like for all my clients to be successful and making gazillions of dollars.
You know? Right.
Gazillions. Not just billions.
That's the next thing after the trillions budget.
Actually, gazillion is a little bit higher than a Googleplex. Okay.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think a Googleplex is something like a Google to a Google
this
power.
This conversation has escaped me and over my head with lots of zeros. But, well, look, Ryan, I think this is good. This is good stuff for people to understand and learn that, look, we make mistakes too, and I'll continue to make some mistakes, but I'll make less of them because I reach out, I talk to friends, I talk to other business owners. I learn a lot from inventors. It's not like I'm teaching inventors and I know everything. I learn a lot from their experiences and some of the things they do too. So
because everything's changing. I mean, certain things stay the same, but everything's evolving, so new things pop up.
Look, a lot of these inventors they're smart people. They're executives, they're doctors, they're lawyers, they're school teachers, they're blue-collar workers. These people are smart. I mean, it's not like, you know, we have to explain to them how to get up in the morning. Everybody has a skill, but what they don't know is what they don't know, and there's no excuse for not reaching out. And with all the free advice that's available through Ron's websites or my websites or just in general, get the process down. Hey, spend a couple bucks to talk to somebody, talk it through, make sure you are going down the right path. The best investment you'll probably ever make.
That's right. Because, you know, if you're not making mistakes, then
you're not
moving forward, okay?
That's true.
All right, well, this has been super. I've learned a lot about the business that you had there at the beginning, Jim.
And we have a guest next week.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, she's a local businesswoman, inventor, and yes, that should be very exciting.
She's a former lawyer.
Former lawyer. Are there former lawyers? Or you're kind of
always a lawyer for life.
Like a Marine.
Like an alcoholic.
Or a Marine or something.
we're not going to go there.
Yeah, okay. Okay. That'll do it for Launch this week. Okay.
That's right. Okay, this has been another exciting issue of Launch, you know, with Jim DeBetta and our producer, Lee Cantor, and, of course, Silent Jay Johnson over there not saying anything. So this is Ron Reardon, and we'll see you next week.